So welcome everyone to this interview where I'm super excited to be talking with Rebecca Fogg. And we're going to be exploring how trauma can impact us, but also how we can be in relationship with that impact and how we can find positive meanings even in sometimes the most painful and difficult experiences. To give you a little bit of Rebecca's background, in 2008, Rebecca Fogg walked away from her New York life and successful career in financial services to move to London, where she co-founded the Institute of Pre-Hospital Care at London's Air Ambulance and continues to work, write, and learn Scottish fiddle. She is the author of A Beautiful Trauma, An Explosion, An Obsession, and A New Lease of Life, which publishers Weekly hailed as a searing debut. Fogg's blending of emotional and medical insights delivers an original perspective on the usual recovery arc this enthralls. So firstly, Rebecca, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Alex. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting into this together. And like a lot of people that have come to this work, you've come because of your own story. So I'd love to start there. Walk us through how you came to learn in your own lived experience about trauma.
So in the middle of a very cold night in January of 2006, I was brushing my teeth before bed and the toilet exploded, sending a sharp hunk of porcelain through the inside of my right wrist, partially amputating my dominant hand. And very long story short, I called 911. I stopped the bleeding. Surgeons repaired most of the damage the next day. And after hundreds of hours of occupational therapy, 45 hospital visits, and a lot of distress, I ended up with actually a highly functional hand, and it's invisibly quite impaired in some kind of amusing ways and slightly dangerous ways. But I'm very lucky in the sense that I have really, really good use of the hand now. But it was obviously a really painful experience, both physically and psychologically.
And walk us through a little bit the context within which that happened. So how your life was at that time, and then how this experience then changed your direction.
At that time, I was in my late 30s. I was living in Brooklyn, New York. I was working very, very hard at a job in a global financial services firm. I had just been promoted to vice president several weeks before, was getting to know my new job, my new colleagues. And I had a really active social life, lots of friends who were of my family, and just generally, you know, very busy. And I would say not necessarily focused on meta life, really just grinding through and, you know, that busy all the time, really focused quite on work and my personal relationships.
Yeah, it sounds like you were giving your all to life as you knew it, but there wasn't much space for reflection around what that direction was.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say, you know, there was space for worry. I was a good worrier. That's how I managed to make sure that bad things didn't happen at work. And yeah. I was fantastic at strategy because I can foresee all the things that could go wrong. So, you know, it wasn't that I was not thinking at all, but yes, it was very, very focused on the moment and the way life was. And, you know, almost no breathing room. I did, you know, love and still love to read and to, you know, participate in culture and things like that. And I find that those were probably the smallish windows through which I was experiencing the more existential contemplation. But yeah, there was just not space at that point in my life, or I wasn't making the space in my life for that sort of contemplation.
So then you had this experience. How, obviously there was the physical healing journey and the 45 hostel visits and so on that went on, but also this experience then changed the direction of your life. So walk us through how, my sense of that happened in a sort of series of stages as opposed to with one big moment, but walk us through that.
Yeah. So you're absolutely right that initially, you know, all of the focus was on the physical recovery. But from the very beginning, you know, I kept a journal during the you know, first 6 months, essentially, like scratching it out with my left hand. So it's nearly.
I was wondering how you wrote the journal.
Yeah. And because immediately it felt like something that was going to be important and life-changing. And it was so difficult to understand myself. You know, it's like while I was going through it, it just felt incomprehensible. The words that the doctors were using, you know, this feeling of how could I still be here? And everything looks familiar, but I feel so completely different. I feel broken. I feel alienated. So right from the beginning, I had this sense that I'm going to need to make sense of this. And in my journal, I mean, every week it says, I just hope this means something, because it was just so hard. It was just so difficult in a way that I had never experienced anything before. So I would say, you know, the awareness that this was momentous and would have impact was immediate, but figuring out what it would mean to my life, I would say is ongoing. And because after a certain point, the crisis has passed, but the real work, at least for me, was figuring out, you know, integrating this life experience into your worldview, into your understanding, and perhaps most importantly, being able to continue to hope and be optimistic, even though you know these terrible things can happen. So there was that crisis period, there was the physical recovery. And then I would say it was over subsequent years, actually, where I, you know, was thinking about this a lot and began to write about it seriously. Those were the seeds of the book. And almost the more I wrote about it, the more I discovered there was to understand. And over the course of time, discovered a contemplative process, you know, got into meditation and found that the very little that I knew about Buddhist teachings resonated a lot, helping me understand how to be, how simply to be, as opposed to just achieving, surviving, that sort of thing. So I would say it went from, you know, that intense experience where you have to get through the crisis mode to really a long, ever continuous period of just learning from it.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's often very challenging when we go through these kinds of life experiences is that there's a lot of change in how we think and we feel. And it can feel quite difficult to find ground, if that makes sense. Like we can have days where we feel really optimistic and we can sort of see the positive, and then other days where it just feels completely hopeless. And in a sense, part of that experience of transformation is that the place that we landed in ourselves pre the experience is difficult to land back to. And I'm interested in some of those emotional places that you went to and how you helped navigate that sort of changing territory.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would say in the most intense period of recovery, which was really the first 3 to 6 months, there was so much grief and loneliness, which I think surprised me. And, you know, I'm still understanding what was that grief, you know, and perhaps it's in sense a loss of innocence. These things can happen. Although really I'd always known that. But just that sense of, you know, grief, anxiety, loneliness, alienation, you know, being foreign to yourself. So those were a lot of the really intense feelings. So there was a period of that. But actually, you know, juxtaposed with, you know, the gratitude and knowledge of my good fortune and having friends and family who would step in and help, and not just friends and family, colleagues, neighbors, strangers. You know, what I talk about is the beauty of the experience. And to be clear, I don't believe there's beauty in every trauma. Absolutely not. But I saw it in mine in terms of, you know, my passion for medical science, and it turned me into a writer. So, you know, these alternating experiences were, you know, that pain of trauma as it felt to me, as well as, you know, the gratitude, the joy, the love. And then, you know, later on, I think it's, you know, the intense, difficult emotions, you know, have definitely subsided a lot. But now there's, you know, there's some difficult emotions in understanding maybe why the experience felt that way to me, understanding what it was about my, you know, I mean, one's response to trauma, one's experience of trauma is driven by biological factors, psychological factors, socio-environmental factors. And actually many of them are beyond our knowledge or control. But what I have learned to understand about mine, you know, there are circumstances of my, you know, my environment and my worldview and growing up and everything that I think contributed to some of my difficult emotions. And so I sometimes feel grief when I recognize that, when I recognize experiences that might have made this one harder for me, or when I think about other people that I let down because I simply didn't understand enough what they were going through or recognize what I was going through. So I think it's, you know, it's a mix of difficult and pleasant emotions. And they're really intertwined. Some of them you just can't have one without the other. And perhaps one of the things I've learned best to appreciate is this, you know, this experience, I would say coupled with COVID, really, you know, knocked the expectation out of me that you can control what happens and that you can just, you know, rebound at will from anything. It's made me accept impermanence more and be able to, I'd say, see the tensions and subtleties in things and not be quite as distressed about them as I might have been.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to come back in a little bit to some of the inner journey and some of the meaning making from the experience. But I'd also love to touch on, you mentioned sort of biopsychosocial elements of the experience. And I know that part of your journey was to embrace your love of science and to use that lens through which to understand your experience. So share a bit about that.
Yeah. So this was a really unexpected and wonderful outcome of the accident. In the days following the accident, you know, nobody could really tell me what was going to happen to next. Even the doctors couldn't reassure me that I would have a useful hand because so much could still go wrong in the healing process that it would have just been irresponsible to predict. So that unknowing was very difficult. And I, by chance, met an acquaintance who had also gone through a life-threatening experience, injury. And he said that I should study the anatomy of the hand because, he said, if I understand what it's trying to do in healing, then when it achieves some milestone, I'll understand just how hard it worked there and be really happy. But when it's progressing slowly or not at all, I'll understand why and I won't be so demoralized. Hmm. And he was absolutely right. It had all of those effects, but I think what neither of us expected is that it ignited an insatiable curiosity about all of the science underpinning my accident and my injury. And so I ended up getting into reconstructive surgery and neuroscience and psychology. And, you know, ultimately it all leads to philosophy. And so I got a lot of things out of that. First of all, just practically speaking, it was a sense of purpose and achievement at a time when I was really dependent on other people. There was so little I could do to myself, you know, little I could do for myself. Yeah. I had a useless hand. My mind was muddled with medication and trauma. I was in pain, but I could study and I could learn. I also think it helped me, you know, connect better with my clinicians. But on top of that, I would say, you know, more existentially, just understanding that all of the difficult emotions that I was feeling were completely normal really helped me feel less broken and alone. And then learning all of the ways that the body is continually trying to help us survive and thrive, I just found them so astonishing and hopeful that it made me more optimistic. And that was really important.
It's interesting because I think sometimes our reaction can be when we have, you know, physical or emotional or so on injury, is that people don't want to understand what's happening because the fear is that it's going to create more anxiety, like it's going to give them more things that they can become concerned about. So I think it's a really interesting and helpful message that actually that can be, that knowledge and that understanding can actually be used in an empowering way.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I would always say, again, people's experience and response to trauma is going to be different, and what they need will be different. But absolutely consider it, because you might be surprised what you find. And really, it made me feel less alone. Even when I felt so incapacitated and unable to help myself, there were processes that were continuing without me knowing anything about them. And I found that very hopeful. So I would absolutely, you know, encourage people to give it a try, see if it works for them. But the other thing is too, it can help you understand maybe what's happening in your interactions with healthcare professionals better. And anytime you better understand what's going on and can better participate in decisions that are being made, you know, that's important.
Yeah, and one of the things that also you touched on, which I'm interested to explore as well, is that there's the experience that happens, but there's also the history, the background, the context within which that experience happens. And so, for example, you mentioned around your own personal journey then allowed you to understand other people's traumas in different ways. And so I'm interested to understand how you see that role of context and environment and history in how we then respond to a traumatic event.
Mm-hmm. Well, in my research, you know, I studied a lot about both post-traumatic stress disorder as well as resilience. And, you know, these are all incredibly complex subjects. And, you know, I'm not an expert or speaking from the position of as a physician or a scientist. However, you know, what I did learn is that, for instance, you know, resilience is correlated with things like, aptitude and problem solving. And you can imagine that makes sense, because traumas, crises create problems. And so if you are experienced in solving problems, then, you know, there are going to be certain aspects of the situation that you might be able to resolve or with help. Well, you know, in terms of my background and context, I have an MBA. That is an entire degree based on problem solving. Resilience is also correlated with education level. And that also, as I understand it, makes sense, because, again, education is about problem solving, among other things. It's also correlated with, socioeconomic, level and that sort of thing. So all of this is what, you know, I call the meta tragedy around tragedy and trauma, is that, you know, everybody deserves to be financially secure and to have the education that they need to thrive and all of that. But when people are deprived of these things, it can actually make it harder for them to come through a crisis or cope with adversity in a resilient way. And so I think, you know, one of my biggest learnings was that I think the cultural narrative is very much around, you know, rebounding and, you know, you got this, and almost as if it's, you know, personal character and will that solely determine, you know, resilience. And it is really so many different factors. And I think we need to have compassion for that, not judge ourselves or others when our response isn't what we would expect or hope, or we're finding it more difficult than we think it should be. And so, you know, I saw a lot of correlations between, my life and, you know, things that I was fortunate to have had experienced, which prepared me for this. At the same time, you know, it was traumatic to me. So there are probably reasons that I will never know that it was, but I also, you know, for instance, I was at ground zero in 9/11. So that was another experience. You know, I was in the office building next door. So there were certainly, you know, experiences I've had in my life that make the fear of being alone in a crisis, you know, very intense. And so that probably also informed my response to this. I was living alone at the time. So after my family of origin, you know, jumped in and did absolutely everything for 3 weeks, then I had to sort out my own care, and I wasn't ready to care for myself. So that was a very frightening experience for me. And, these are, you know, layers upon layers of life experience that end up, you know, being intertwined and expressing themselves in a particular way when we meet challenge.
Yeah. I'd love to explore this theme around, you know, I know it's called different things, resilience, post-traumatic growth, and so on, because I think, and you touched on it, I think one of the issues can be that people tend to think about it being a binary thing, that there's either a place where it feels hopeless and there isn't any meaning, or there's a place where there's lots of positive meaning. And certainly my experience of going through difficult life experiences is it seems to be a kind of a needle that moves back and forth quite quickly in any given day, week, or moment sort of thing.
Yeah, that's absolutely my experience. And that is consistent with, you know, what I've learned through my research. It's life. Mm. And it is complex. And there are things that, you know, we won't understand until later. There are things that we don't understand until another experience, you know, highlights them for us. I think it's, you know, it's a range of experiences. And that binary, definitely, I agree with you. I think that binary approach is really unhelpful. You know, I referred to it earlier, the you got this, you know, this notion that there's a beginning and an end to it, that you get, you know, you'll get through it, you'll get past this. And also, by the way, that it's all up to you, you know. So people very often ask me, you know, what's my advice to, you know, other people experiencing adversity or trauma? And I understand that that question comes from a place of compassion, but it frustrates me because, again, you know, we are all experiencing something completely different. So what works for me isn't going to necessarily work for somebody else. And, you know, and also actually, you know, when we are traumatized or going through a really difficult time, that might be when we are actually least able to help ourselves. So I really wish that we could tilt the conversation about resilience away from this binary, you know, you're going to get through and it's going to be you who does it, to more of a, you know, it is a process. It can be a lifelong process of just integrating the experience into, you know, your worldview. And actually, it would be wonderful if when we personally are feeling in a moment of emotional and psychological well-being, that we could challenge ourselves to look around us and see who needs help before they have to ask, rather than placing this massive expectation on people that just when you need help the most, well, you're supposed to be bootstrapping yourself out of it. That's not realistic.
So one of the things that I found myself thinking about is this, the psychological term of locus of control, that the idea that we can influence the not necessarily the ultimate outcome, but we can influence the journey and the direction that we're moving in. And it struck me as you were talking that some of your previous career background and the way that you approached, right, let's understand the science and let's see this as an opportunity to grow. And, you know, you mentioned some of the factors that influence that, for example, you know, education, socioeconomic background and so on. And I'm wondering, someone that's watching this interview and they're feeling like that's an area that there's an opportunity for them to move forwards, that to have more of us, not necessarily to influence the ultimate outcome, but the way they meet the journey. And what are some of the things that can help them develop that?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. And, you know, I will share what has worked for me and what I've learned through, for instance, meditation and therapy and things like that. But, you know, first of all, trying to identify how you're feeling and accepting that those feelings are acceptable, you know, that whatever you're feeling is natural and normal. And I think that that is a really important place to start, because trauma can feel very destabilizing. And, you know, in a culture where, you know, independence is so highly valued and this notion of being able to control it and, you know, propel yourself out of it is so strong, there can be shame associated with feeling vulnerable. And, you know, that's not helpful and it's not fair, really. So I think it's first, you know, try to identify how you're feeling and accept that those feelings are natural and try to have some compassion for yourself. And if it's hard to do that, think about a friend or a loved one that you have, you know, comforted in a time of need, and how you would want to treat them, and you treat that, you know, treat yourself that way. Another thing to do is, and again, you know, when you are in a really difficult situation, it can be really hard to have these kinds of positive thoughts. But understand that you can have influence. So just recognizing that the outcome isn't determined. Nobody knows what's going to happen next. So even when, you know, maybe your mind and body are telling you that, you know, you will never have a positive feeling again, or you will never be able to do anything else for yourself again, you know, recognize that there are probably aspects of your experience that are, you know, not determined. So I think it's, you know, recognizing impermanence, recognizing that, you know, nobody knows for sure. You know, this is contrary to, there may be discussions you've had with a physician about, you know, certain physical aspects, et cetera, but in terms of, you know, how, you know, whether you'll survive and thrive, emotionally later, you know, that hasn't been determined. So there's possibility. And then, you know, very practical things, even if the first two are really, really hard, again, ask for help. It can be really difficult in our society, but people want to help. I mean, I was astonished, literally strangers, neighbors, colleagues, people do want to help. And so, you know, ask, whether it's somebody who can just listen non-judgmentally to how you're feeling, someone who's been through this experience before. Patient forums are fantastic. When I was recovering, I read loads and loads and loads of memoirs of all different kinds of medical catastrophes and traumas. And, you know, I'm smiling that they were, you know, they were really grueling at times, but just reading the stories, everybody's story matters, and reading that, you know, those stories of how they got through the day to day, how they got through those days when they didn't feel like there was anything that would change for the better. You know, some days they couldn't do anything for themselves, other days they could. That was really important. So, you know, asking for help, learning other people's stories, being witnessed, I think those are all really important things. And I did want to make one note on, you know, the correlations with resilience. You know, they're not all, those things are not all things associated with, you know, good fortune and privilege, you know, the education, socioeconomic. There's also, you know, people with a spiritual belief, you know, so that doesn't necessarily a particular, you know, a god or a religion, but just people with a spiritual practice, you know, people with, you know, confidence in problem solving, people who, you know, see opportunity. So there are some things about mindset, which, you know, can be cultivated. You know, they aren't just, you know, products of being in, you know, born in a very helpful place and time.
So I want to explore more also this piece around how we show up for each other. Because you made the point a little bit earlier around sometimes the expectation that can be placed upon people that are going through a difficult experience. And in a way, sometimes and you mentioned it in your story, that after that initial 3 weeks of everyone sort of comes in and responds, and then people go, right, Rebecca's got this, right, we can sort of, and in a way, it's not just what happens, but it's also what happens around us, right, in what happens. And so I'm really curious as to you know, how we ask for that help, but also how we can identify when others are in need, and how we can best be of service to each other.
Yeah. So, you know, in my situation, it was family of origin that stepped in for the first few weeks. And, you know, and living in different states and all of that coming in. And so, you know, they couldn't stay forever, et cetera. And after that, actually, you know, it was my therapist, fortunately, I was in therapy at the time, who had suggested that I ask my friends to set up a visiting schedule. And that seems like the most natural thing in the world to me now, but it literally did not occur to me that I could ask for that much help. And of course, when I asked my best friend to set it up, she immediately thought it was a brilliant idea. And there were way too many people who wanted to help versus what I felt I could handle. And so I think it's just, you know, trying to change our habit of thought to what can I do for myself, to what can I ask somebody to do with me or for me? You know, people like to help. And it, you know, it makes us feel stronger. It makes us feel joyful. So I think that that's just trying to get over this notion, you know, aspects of independence can be wonderful. You know, I love to learn how to do DIY. It's nice to learn things. It's nice to, you know, achieve something, but there shouldn't be any shame around asking for help. And there's certainly no medals given for not asking for help. So I think that that's one thing. In terms of, you know, being able to better recognize help, I think a lot of that just comes from life experience. You know, the more we've been through, the more we can empathize and perhaps imagine what might be going on that isn't said. And then the other thing is too, just overcoming, I think there's also some social reticence, perhaps again, because the premium that we place on independence, there's some social reticence to asking if someone needs help or just giving it to them, whether they ask for it or not. You know, I had people literally say, I'm bringing you dinner tonight, or slipping notes under the door saying, you know, you don't know me. I'm on the third floor, apartment D, but if you need anything, you know, please knock on the door. And so, you know, I was going and knocking on doors and be like, you open this peanut butter jar and can you do this? You know, can someone pick up this prescription for me? So
I'm also sorry to interrupt you, but I laugh because I particularly the image that I have of New York being a little bit like London, that people can live in apartment blocks and never meet their neighbors. And in a way, something really beautiful about the opportunity to be of service to someone in such a simple way, like opening a jar, but actually in a really meaningful way. And actually, I wonder what that did for your sense of community and connection.
Huge. I mean, it was just, you know, if the accident itself reinforced the fact that, you know, life is risky, all of these many, many situations, and I could go on all day about situations where people I didn't know very well or complete strangers stepped in and did something. And they just completely reinforced the fact that, you know, people want to help. People are kind. You need to give them a chance to. And yes, you talk about like the cultures of New York and London. You know, I've lived in London for 15 years now and I get it. But I find so often that, you know, that sort of, you know, veneer of, you know, get out of my way, I'm on my way to work, or, you know, whatever, or even just, you know, the polite reticence and, you know, I'm not going to get into your space, et cetera. It really is just the surface. You know, someone comes walking towards you in the street with kind of a stony face, catch their eye and give them a giant smile. 9 times out of 10, they're going to smile back. And so, you know, that knocking on the door, hey, could you help me? I think is much more likely to be met with, you know, a positive response. And the other thing is, whenever you ask for help, you're giving other people permission to do the same. So you are modeling this behavior that we need to, you know, help society be more connected. You know, I think at our base, we all want that. And so whenever you ask for help, you're not being weak. You are modeling the behavior that's going to help everybody live better.
You know, also, I really like challenging those cultural boundaries in London where people don't talk to each other. It's like, because once people realize you're not going to murder them or steal all their money, people really like to connect. And it's like particularly connecting to people that are normally invisible, like, you know, the people sort of, you know, cleaning the street or tending the sort of the communal garden, that, and just go up and say, wow, this looks really beautiful, thank you so much for doing it. You know, it's like,
you
too. It's like under that surface, we all want to feel connected. And it's beautiful how this experience was in a way a gateway to have those connections.
Yeah, absolutely. I met so many people that I never would have met any other way. You know, there was a whole community at the hospital of people who, you know, we'd all gone through these horrendous accidents and, you know, we're showing each other scars and wounds and talking about it and everything. But just this very you know, deep and beautiful connection of just, you know, I'll never know exactly what it's like for you, but I think I know what it's like to, you know, to feel lost, to feel broken, and then to feel that connection, you know, which is just that connection alone in a time of need can be so healing. Yeah. And that's something that we can, you know, we can help each other too.
So you called your book Beautiful Trauma. And I know you've mentioned it a few times in the interview. I know that you're not imposing that idea on different people's experiences, but I'm really curious as to how that title came to you and what that really means to you.
Yeah. It came to me just in reflecting on, you know, what the experience meant to me and continues to mean to me. So as I'd mentioned before in my journal, you know, from the moment it happened, I just knew it was going to be a formative experience. And it was so difficult initially that I just was hoping that it would mean something good somehow. And, you know, as the distance increased between, you know, me and that, you know, that crisis period of 3 to 6 months after the accident, I could do a more clear-eyed, I think assessment is a strong word for it. But, you know, it was emerging, you know, what I had got out of it, and a lot of change came out of it. You know, I really do think of my life as before and after, and I was living a good life before, but after I did a hard think about whether I wanted to continue exactly on the same path. And the answer was no, that I wanted to rebuild a life that was, you know, more in keeping with my values, that there was more time for that contemplation, more time for, you know, just experiencing life and helping one another. And so I ended up working in healthcare for quite a while. I ended up writing the book.
I'm guessing you read it as well.
Yeah, I read, like, I mean, it's so muddled now. I can't tell the difference between reading and writing. I could probably recite it. But so it was in, you know, reflecting periodically on what has this meant to me, where I just saw so many positives that could not have transpired if this most awful thing hadn't happened. And that this, you know, this beauty was intrinsically linked with this trauma. And I really was surprised by this coexistence. I was encouraged by the coexistence. You know, obviously difficult things still happen. There was COVID and all of that. But it has stuck with me that, you know, even when the worst thing happens, there is a possibility. It won't necessarily lead to any positives, but there is a possibility. And I wanted the title to reflect that possible coexistence.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So Rebecca, if people that want to find out more about you and your work, so I know they'll be below the video, there's a link tree with various links that people can find. But say a bit more about what you're up to now, and yeah, obviously people can also find the book as well.
Sure. Well, I continue to work in strategy and operations. I find, you know, that analytical side of my brain, it's very rewarding. It's the problem solving. I've always enjoyed that. But I also continue to write. And I really do feel a passion for exploring these existential questions and, you know, broad human experience in writing. And I will continue to do that. So please do look out for that. The paperback of Beautiful Trauma comes out pretty soon. And, you know, other than that, I think it's really, you know, I continue to volunteer and to be engaged in discussions of trauma and resilience. And I really hope that this book will help people through difficult experiences and perhaps give them some joy of discovery.
Yeah, beautiful. Rebecca, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was a wonderful discussion.